From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Earlier today, Florida Governor Rick Scott got an aerial tour of Jacksonville, the northern city inundated with historic flooding after Irma. Yesterday, it was so severe, the sheriff's department rescued more than 350 people. Here's Governor Scott.
They up here, they're just shocked how the flood came in. What it teaches you is that when we have a disaster like this, you really need to watch the weather and you need to listen to your local officials. If they say to evacuate, you need to evacuate.
Ryan Bank is a reporter at WJCT in Jacksonville. And Ryan, I know you've been trying to keep your technology going there. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So what's the status now? What's open? What's closed? What's passable?
Well, we are seeing quite a bit of the floodwaters receding in a number of areas, but there's still some isolated neighborhoods and some pieces of specific neighborhoods around the city that are still kind of impassable. We had water that was going up above the St. John's River and into a lot of our downtown, especially those closest to the river, of course, and a lot of that water has receded, but police are still blocking off certain roads just out of the safety for people because cars are getting stuck and people are getting stranded. And as you said, more than 350 people were rescued from the beginning of the storm and then its after effects.
Well, and let's remind people that your beautiful city is cut in half by St. John's River. So, you know, the only way to get around was to go over bridges. Bridges were closed for a while. They reopened this morning. But still, we hear stoplights are out. It's that old, you know, after a storm, treat every intersection as a four-way stop.
Right, and sometimes I think it's difficult for, or seems difficult for people to remember that, but we do still have a lot of stoplights that are out, but our electric utility has about 500 crews out today trying to restore power to individual homes. Shelters even lost power, and even hospitals, and then about 100 crews that are going around assessing damage and cutting and tossing debris and getting it out of the middle of roadways. We had a lot of downed trees, some of them very old and very large, and it makes it kind of treacherous to try to get around in certain areas of the city.
Right. Just how historic was this flooding? We saw the pictures, but we're kind of getting used to these pictures of streets turned to rivers, you know, from Harvey on over. So how historic there in Jacksonville?
Well, you know, just like cities like Miami in Florida, Jacksonville is no stranger to getting a little bit of flooding every once in a while from bad thunderstorms. But this flooding was incredible. I think the National Weather Service said that we haven't seen this kind of flooding for more than 150 years. Mm-hmm. The last recorded flooding, it broke the record, which was set in about 1864.
Yeah. Look, your mayor there, Lenny Curry, gave a briefing earlier today. He talked about yesterday being rescue day. Just tell us a little more. We understand one of these rescues unfolded during a live shot on television.
Right, yeah. There was even a news reporter for a local TV affiliate had tweeted out a picture of the photographer actually pulling someone out of a car that had gotten stuck in those floodwaters. And again, we saw this storm surge getting up to, in some areas, about 5 feet over what the normal high tide is for the river. So a lot of people were getting stuck and requiring rescue, but we saw a lot of dramatic scenes of neighbors and even out-of-towners who just so happened to be here at the wrong time for a vacation and ended up getting stuck. There was a couple of Vermonters who were helping people clear debris in their neighborhoods.
Yeah, people forget that when you're swamped in a car, it's not like you can push against that water with a car door. And if the electricity in the car goes out, you can't lower your window. So
right.
This one scene where a photographer, a photojournalist put the camera down during a live shot to go rescue someone. That's, you know, says a lot. We also know you had your own, you know, we've heard about the Cajun Navy from Louisiana that went to Texas. There was soon the Texas Navy, and you've got they're calling themselves the Florida Cracker Navy.
Right, and this comes from a term used for those that are pretty firmly Floridian. I mean, whose families were here, you know, during the colonial era is when they came in. So generation after generation, there was talk a lot about this on different local TV affiliates. Again, different just kind of Good Samaritans who were going around with their own boats. being a coastal city, we do have a boater culture, and a lot of people like getting out on the water. So it wasn't really that much of a surprise to see the people of Jacksonville kind of pulling together to help out these search and rescue crews.
Well, and I just a note, it may not be over. We're hearing that dangerous high tides could create some dangerous conditions during the week.
Well, and it will ebb and flow for the better part of a week. We were warned by not only our mayor, but also National Weather Service meteorologist Angie Agnetti, who's been stationed here throughout the storm, that because of the way the river works, high tide comes in, low tide goes out. Just because you see floodwaters receding around your home, for instance, it doesn't necessarily mean that in a few hours it won't be back.
Right. Ryan Benk of WJCT in Jacksonville, like staying on the air there. Ryan, we really appreciate it. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, Robin, I have a friend who still only buys cars with manual windows for exactly that reason.
Or you keep an instrument, something, a hammer something in your car that you can break it with.
Well, over the last week or so, there has been an incredible amount of reporting from Florida, and we've seen many reporters out in the middle of dangerous storm conditions to cover the storm.
Ooh, all right, here it comes. Whoa! Irma. Oh, here we go.
Yeah, we're okay out here. We're okay, but yeah, we both got whipped around just now.
The angle of approach can make all the difference, and a storm that's more parallel...
Oh. Hey, pal. He's walking his dog. We saw him last night. You got to get back inside, pal. We got the backside of the storm still to come. Please get back in.
That's CNN's Chris Cuomo telling a Naples resident to go back inside while Cuomo remains outside. Also in there, Mike Bettis with the Weather Channel, Riel Creighton with CBS Miami, and Bill Weir of CNN. Joining us now is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, you know, we've all been watching a lot of this coverage, but what do you think of how it's been done?
Look, it's strangely compelling and hard not to watch in certain ways once you flip it on. And at the same time, from a human level, you take a step back and you say, what the heck are these guys doing out there in some of this points? You saw Gabe Gutierrez. I was watching, turned on over the weekend MSNBC, and he was within a few yards of being smacked by a huge part of a tree that just crashed down. He had a little bit of shelter, but not a lot. There was a CNN reporter who missed, getting hit by a street sign that came whipping through. And the point was hammered home to me when I read something, I think it was by NPR, about how zoos take safety. And they said, well, you know, the funny thing is during one of the last big storms, everything did fine in the zoo except the aviary, the birds, the netting was built to withstand a literal 4 or 5 hurricane. But it wasn't built to withstand the RV that was plucked up by the winds and sent careening through it. And I said, well, if that's the case, you know, that's going to slice up an aviary. What, you know, reporter's judgment or experience isn't going to be able to protect him or her from being hit from surprise. I think a lot more care should be taken. It's a visual story, and you could hear it even on the radio in the clips that you just played. And, you know, it serves to illustrate the force of the winds, but I think these guys take a lot of risks.
They take a lot of risks, but there's also the argument that they are doing a real service by bringing this to their viewers and also, in some cases, getting involved, as we just heard a few moments ago, with a reporter trying to help somebody out who's in trouble. And showing up in places like the Florida Keys and explaining what's going on even before authorities get there in some cases.
Well, look, I'm not saying don't cover these storms. You have places like the Miami Herald, other major Florida papers. Some of them had to evacuate. Some of them just battened down the hatches and stuck it out. You had reporters from the New York Times being warned by their national editor, Mark Lacy, over Twitter and elsewise. Hey, don't do things going out in the middle of this. We want you to cover it. It's a different medium. They don't require video to put things on a website or put things in print in the way that they do for television. And I'm not saying don't cover it. I'm saying you have to be smart. And I think that there's a degree of recklessness. People make careers. People make their names. And there's also an adrenaline rush. And there is something of a public service. I just don't know that the extra public service has to involve people putting themselves so dramatically in harm's way.
The conservative talk radio host Rush Limbaugh and others have criticized the mainstream media for hyping the storm as a way to talk about climate change. On the other hand, some have argued that reporters are not doing enough in connecting these historic hurricanes to the effects of climate change. What do you think about how the media have been addressing that angle?
I think that it's utterly fair. It seems to me that the overwhelming consensus of scientists who study climate say that not only is it making more likely that there will be extreme weather circumstances, but that you can actually start to connect specific instances like the repeated hurricanes that we've seen just in recent days in the last couple of weeks to the fact of climate change. And that the idea that the EPA, the idea that NOAA, the idea that other government agencies shouldn't talk about this or acknowledge that because of the need to do to help out, help reconstruct things in Florida and Texas and other places, that seems to me to be silly. Like the EPA has bigger issues to think about. This is a major one. And the idea that people are trying to politicize it doesn't render it journalistically mute.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thanks so much as always.
You bet.
Our next guest is going to make you jealous, maybe scared, perhaps inspired. His name is Scott Parazynski, and he's been on 7 spacewalks. He has summited Mount Everest and camped in Antarctica. And those are just the latest chapters in his life. His new book is called The Sky Below, A True Story of Summits, Space, and Speed. He joins us from Houston. Scott, welcome to Here and Now.
Thrilled to be with you.
And it's pretty clear reading your book that you had a goal to be an astronaut, to go into outer space. You made sure that everything helps you get there, and you got there. Where did that desire come from?
You know, I was so fortunate to have a front row seat to the Apollo program when I was very young. My father was an engineer, and he worked on the Saturn V boosters that first took men to the moon in the late 60s, early 70s. So I had model rockets and posters on the wall, and I wanted to be the first to set boot prints down on Mars. It didn't quite work out that way for me, but I have no complaints.
Well, along the way, you were training to be an ER doctor.
Correct. Yeah, so I had a strong passion for medicine. I wanted to be able to help people. I wanted to create medical technologies. And I realized that becoming an astronaut was sort of a long shot, very much a long shot. So I found other things that I was equally passionate about. And if the NASA thing didn't turn out well, I would have a career that I would be very excited about and very passionate about.
Well, and let's talk about something else that you tried along the way, which is to be a luge athlete.
Oh, well, thank you for calling me a luge athlete instead of a luger. We're very sensitive about that, I have to say. We prefer slider because we do slide at incredible speeds down these icy tracks. And I was actually recruited for the sport by another Stanford student. This is when I was in medical school at the time. But Bonnie Warner had been the top female finisher in the Sarajevo Olympic Games in 1984. And they were looking to recruit athletes from other sports. And I'd seen the sport of luge, of course, on TV and thought, this is the most exhilarating sport imaginable. I'll never get a chance to try it. And when the opportunity did present itself in this recruiting campaign, I went out for it. And although I didn't quite make the U.S. team, I ended up serving as a coach of that Winter Olympic powerhouse, the Philippine Winter Olympic team. A friend of mine was representing the Philippines, and right. He needed a coach, and that was my ticket to Calgary in 1988.
So with all that background, you finally did get to NASA. Tell us what it was like when that call finally came.
I was really kind of numb. I didn't believe that I was actually going to get a chance to fly in space one day. I sort of expected and was prepared to apply for 10 years or so in a row. In fact, there are a number of folks who did just that. But with tenacity, they were able to live out their childhood dreams. And so really one of the most exciting experiences of my life to get that call and then, of course, to then live it out and get a chance to go launch aboard a space shuttle to float outside the airlock hatch on spacewalks. It's really the greatest job in the universe.
One of the things that I was wondering as I was reading it is, did the luge experience and did the ER doctor experience help you in space?
Absolutely. You know, the mindset of preparation, rigorous training, and I call it pre-visualization. And imagine yourself at the top of a luge track. You're going to be hurtling down at up to 85 miles an hour, pulling high Gs. You really need to kind of get into the zone or a flow state to be prepared for the things that are going to be coming at you at these incredible speeds. And so we would sit down, actually lay down in the start house and go through the entire course ahead of us, moving our bodies exactly as we would do on the track in a few minutes' time. And that repetitive pre-visualization of success, but also having a plan B if things don't work out perfectly, that sort of has been a theme that's been recurrent throughout my career.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Scott Parazynski, whose new book is called The Sky Below, A True Story of Summits, Space, and Speed. Scott, we have left out a couple of incredible moments in your life already, and we've only been talking for a few minutes, but what about the fact that you climbed Mount Everest more than once?
Well, I made it to the top once, but I have spent two seasons on Mount Everest, not by my own choosing, I would say. The first attempt that I made in 2008, I made it up to 24,500 feet when it became apparent that something really, really was amiss with my back. And it turned out I'd actually ruptured a disc in my lumbar spine. And there's really no way to get down except under your own power. So really the most excruciatingly painful experience of my life, hobbling down from those incredible altitudes. And I had surgery when I got back home to Houston. In the following year, I was able to make a round trip to the top of Mount Everest. It doesn't really count unless you make it a round trip.
Yeah, right. Is there something similar about seeing the sunrise from the top of Mount Everest and seeing it from space?
My goodness, it is so gorgeous to see a sunrise from extreme altitude, whether it's in Earth orbit, traveling at 17,500 miles an hour, or from the top of our planet on Mount Everest, 29,000 feet above sea level. The difference, I suppose, is that on Mount Everest, it happens a lot slower. Up in space, we see a sunrise. It lasts perhaps 30 seconds. You see the full spectrum of light. It's just otherworldly, gorgeous. But on top of Mount Everest, I arrived at 4 a.m. in the morning, and I was able to see that same experience, the full curvature of the Earth, but then the sun rising from beyond the horizon, wow. Something I'll never forget.
What about the fact that you were in Tehran right around the time of the Iran hostage crisis?
Yeah, I've lived in some really wonderful but crazy places.
Yeah.
Even prior to that, I was in Beirut, Lebanon, because of my dad's job with the Boeing Airplane Company in international marketing. But we were there during the 1975 Civil War. And then a few years later, we evacuated from Tehran in December of 1978. For a young kid, it was an adventure, of course, but my parents were terrified, as you might imagine.
Well, is part of what you do thrill-seeking in a way? You've experienced so many incredible things that maybe you need to always have something of more of a thrill.
Well, I do enjoy thrills, no doubt about it. But actually, what I enjoy more is the challenge of overcoming difficult situations, difficult environments. I consider myself more of a risk manager as opposed to a risk taker. I'm not a daredevil by any sense, but I prepare rigorously, try to understand the perils that are out there, and then control the ones that I can.
Do you get scared?
I do. One of the more extraordinary life experiences that I had was being part of the STS-120 space shuttle mission, when our crew and mission control had to repair a live solar panel that had ripped apart. But when you're working in a high-functioning team, you're really concerned that you don't let the rest of the team down. And it was just one of NASA's finest moments, I think, to come together with a plan to do something that was truly audacious. And they made it look almost easy.
And you never knew that you'd have to remember how to sew.
I did not, but it came in handy. You know, having sewn up lots of people in the ERs, I was ready to go.
So what has all of this, all of these experiences that you've had, done to your perspective on life? Because in addition to reaching these new heights and going into space and doing spacewalks and competing in luge and everything else, you've also dealt with some stuff in your own family. You've gone through a divorce. You have a daughter who has autism, which I'm sure was a big challenge. What does it do for your perspective that you've had all these incredible experiences at the same time you've been dealing with things that a lot of people have to deal with?
Great question. And you know, I guess what I would first off say is that life is an amazing gift, and to try and pursue life to the fullest is something that was instilled in me by my parents, who were very, very adventurous, but also just a sense of wanting to contribute to society, so to serve our communities, to be part of something bigger than oneself. And so flying in space is very challenging, both on the crew member, but also on our families. And so what I've tried to do in my book is really relate the human experience, not just of the successes, but how I've overcome some of the hurdles in my life, because everyone has them.
One more question, Scott Perwazinski, as somebody who has wanted to do this, and it sounds like you've accepted it won't be you going to Mars, but when do you think we'll get there?
Gosh, you know, it's so exciting to think, Jeremy, that the first Martians have already been born. I really believe this, that there are young people in school right now. I don't know if they're kindergartners or postdocs, but somewhere in that continuum, the very first Martian explorers have probably already been born pursuing their dreams. And I would hope that within the next 10 to 20 years, we would accelerate our pathway to get to Mars. I think the majority of the technologies that we'll need to get there exist. There are companies out there that have an incredible ambition to do this. I'm sure you've heard of SpaceX. And of course, NASA itself has a longstanding goal to send astronauts to Mars. We've learned a great deal with our robotic exploration, but it's the ultimate human destiny, I think, to send crews there. And in fact, not just to set a flag, but to actually colonize and deeply explore that planet.
And thanks to Matt Damon, we now know what to do if we get stuck on Mars.
There you go. Exactly. It'll be just like that, only different.
That's Scott Perwazinski, whose new book is called The Sky Below, A True Story of Summits, Space, and Speed. Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
Wonderful to be with you. Thank you.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started. Started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Moody's Analytics now estimates the total cost of hurricanes Harvey and Irma will reach between $150 and $200 billion. To give you some perspective, the cost of Hurricane Katrina's destruction was about $160 billion in today's dollars and was the costliest natural disaster in American history. Moody's also estimates an additional $20 to $30 billion in lost economic output because of the storms. Joining us now is Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. And by the looks of it, Ali, somebody working basically 7 days a week now to cover the hurricane.
Yeah.
Well, we mentioned the cost of those two storms combined will rival Katrina.
Yep.
How do they break down between Harvey and Irma?
So it looks like Irma at this point, if you took it at the $150 to $200 billion cost for both storms, a little less than half of that will be Irma. So Harvey's going to be the more costly of the two. It may not be that much. The way that estimate breaks down is somewhere around $100 to $110 billion for Harvey and somewhere between about $64 to $92 billion for Irma. And the difference is that Irma, while less powerful and less devastating, hit more developed areas. So the cost of reconstruction in those areas is greater than the areas in Texas that were hit.
And who will shoulder those costs? Is that just the taxpayer?
You know, that's a really interesting question. Some of it is public infrastructure that'll be built up. Some of it is FEMA money that is taxpayer money. Some of it is corporate money. A lot of it is insurance. So it's going to be a lot of different things. Ultimately, these hurricanes tend to increase GDP growth in the repair phase. So if you looked at it just from that, and I find that to be a very cold and inhumane way to look at it, but from an economic perspective, what you see after a disaster is an immediate drop in GDP because people are not working, and then you see an immediate rise in GDP as all the rebuilding takes place, and then it generally goes back to normal. The exception was after Katrina. It took a very, very long time for New Orleans to get back to normal.
After a disaster, obviously everybody wants to do everything they can to help those who are suffering, but are there people bringing up the idea that maybe the government shouldn't be paying for all of these things after a natural disaster, especially in cases where you know, people are living in places that are prone to this sort of thing.
So there are sort of three discussions here, briefly. One is America has been all about occupy, you know, the human spirit overcoming nature,
right,
living in floodplains, living in low-lying areas, and that maybe we shouldn't have encouraged that. One could make that entire argument for the peninsula of Florida. I mean, this was a place that didn't make sense to settle when it was first settled, and it has been in the same way that Dubai is a man against nature fight by putting a city in the desert. Some argue that Florida is a man against nature fight, and it's not clear who's winning it. On the Texas side, it's even more interesting because the areas that flooded in Texas, particularly Port Arthur and Beaumont, that is the heart of oil country. That is some of the richest country in the entire
right.
world, and it's a little puzzling that more money didn't go into preparing infrastructure for, even if it is a flood of every 500 years or 1,000 years, we actually can prepare for it on the front end as opposed to the back end.
I remember after Hurricane Sandy, people were saying if New York had spent $20 billion, they could have built gates in the harbor and
right.
stopped a lot of that flooding instead of spending a lot more money after the storm. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, co-host of Velshi and Rule, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
What's left of Irma is moving across Alabama today, leaving flooding behind in Georgia, South Carolina. And Floridians continue to assess her wake, especially in the Florida Keys. FEMA Administrator Brock Long said today that 25% of the homes in the island chain have been destroyed. And many residents want back into sea, but officials aren't letting them. Here are some voices on CBS.
I have water, I have food, I have dogs, and I can't get to
my
house.
This should have been thought out
20
a while
miles
ago.
Away.
Right now, we don't know where to go.
Get somebody who does know. We might have them. Florida officials are still checking the dozens of bridges that connect the Keys to see if they're safe. Parts of the Keys have no water or power, and communication is tough. But we've reached Roman Gastesi on North Key Largo. He's the administrator of Monroe County, which includes the Keys. So, Roman, speak to your residents first. How soon can everybody come back?
Okay, as far as the residents and the business owners, if you're in the Upper Keys and we're cutting it off around mile marker 80, you can come back today. Now, there's limited services. There's no running water or very little running water, very little electricity. Some areas actually still have electricity, believe it or not. And the sewer system is not fully operational. It depends on where you are. But I know folks want to get down and look at the businesses and start working on their houses and that kind of thing. So the Upper Keys, you're welcome to come back today. Now, the middle and the lower keys, we're still working on. There's still a lot of debris on the road. So, you know, we're going to get this done. This happens all the time all over the world, and people always bounce back, and we will too.
Roman, the pictures we're seeing in daylight today are devastating. What's your sense of what's there?
Well, there are some parts of the Keys that are, I guess, devastated, and that's a big word. But it's nothing that we can't overcome and rebuild. It's something that's expected from a storm of this strength and magnitude.
Well, yesterday the Defense Department said it might be necessary to evacuate all 10,000 residents who stayed behind because of concerns that there wasn't an ability to get water and food and gas, oil in. What's the sense today?
That's absolutely ridiculous. I can't wait to get my hands on that person to say that.
Okay.
And I'm usually an easygoing guy, but that is so ridiculous. That's somebody that is really ignorant because there might be some challenges with electricity. Yes, there's some challenges with the running water and sewer, but we can easily overcome that. I mean, that's ridiculous to even consider taking everybody out of the Keys.
Okay.
No, absolutely.
Okay, so we get that message out. But, I mean, looking forward, storms are predicted to get stronger, not weaker. You have any thoughts of what you might have learned, or is it too soon to even, you know, be thinking that way?
No, not really. We're looking at it. We see it. The homes that were built to the new standards, the 180 mile an hour standards, and did pretty well. I mean, they got their beat up a little bit, but their structures are fine. And so that's where we're headed. That's where we've been headed. We're starting to raise the roads. We're starting to raise all our infrastructure for sea level rise. Everything we've been building in the last few years, we've been raising it 2 or 3 feet. So we're thinking globally and acting locally.
That's Monroe County Administrator Roman Gastesi in North Key Largo. Roman, thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Yeah. Well, and they will try. We'll continue to follow Irma recovery efforts. Mexico, they're still reeling in one region from that earthquake. But today is also a day of commemoration in Mexico. We want to take a minute to tell that story. 170 years ago, the U.S. and Mexico were engaged in a bloody war. Mexico lost, along with half its territory. Lesser known fact, some European immigrants, mainly Irish, deserted the American army and joined the Mexican side in that battle. Rodrigo Cervantes of KJZZ's Fronteras Desk starts our story at a parade in August in Mexico City to remember those fighters.
I am steps away from the former convent of Churubusco, a 16th century building in Mexico City. Today the roads are closed and the crowds are waiting for a parade that will recreate the beginning of a bloody battle that was fought here 170 years ago. In August 20th, 1847, the Mexican forces marched on these streets. They would use the thick walls of a convent to protect themselves from the invading U.S. Army. And the bullet holes in the facade are still a reminder of that day. The approaching sound of bagpipes might not be surprising in military parades in the U.S., but it's quite unusual here in Mexico. That music comes from La Banda de Gaitas del Batallón de San Patricio, or the St. Patrick's Battalion Pipes and Drums. It is a Mexican band named after the more than 170 European immigrants, most of them Irish, who fought in Mexico against the Americans. Los Patricios, or St. Patrick's Battalion, were deserters of the U.S. Army. They escaped famine in Europe, but in the U.S. were discriminated for their religious beliefs and drafted to fight a war they considered unjust. They fled the American army and joined Mexico, a nation that shared their Catholic faith and offered them land and freedom. David Costello is among the guests of honor in the parade. He is the acting head of the mission from Ireland in Mexico and came to celebrate the long-standing bonds between Mexico and his country.
Mexico was our biggest trading partner in Latin America. I think over 60% of our exports in Latin America come directly to Mexico. So it is a very important economic partner for us. But it's also a country where we have deep historical ties.
Costello says the Irish heritage in Mexico might not be as well known as in Boston, Chicago, and New York, but it is equally relevant.
The battles that they fought 170 years ago are still issues that are relevant today. And so the cause of the San Patricio Battalion is also the cause today for the poor, for the migrants, and particularly those that fight on behalf of human rights.
As a Mexican military band approaches, the sounds of two cultures meld together. There are high school bands and police officers wearing traditional charro suits marching down the street. And behind them, three men ride horses, waving to the crowds and wearing military clothes from the mid-1800s. They are actors playing three historic characters in the Battle of Churubusco. One of them is the leader of St. Patrick's Battalion, Irish immigrant John Riley.
Mexicanos, es momento de que os portéis dignos de este nombre. La patria mexicana ha sido invadida por el ejército de los Estados Unidos.
Faking accent and using old Spanish, the actor playing Riley invites citizens to join the battle against the invading U.S. troops.
Es mucho Mexico! Viva Mexico! Viva!
Mexico was just 25 years old back then, and most of those who fought were poor civilians armed with improvised weaponry. The Battle of Churubusco and the war were lost against the rising superpower, the United States.
I think that's important and it's relevant to go back to history also and reread it and to see where we failed, what we should never forget, that we should always stick together.
That's Gabriela Eugenia López, coordinator of heritage for the government of Mexico City. She's part of the organizing committee of the Battle of Churubusco parade.
Now we are not at war, but we are renegotiating a trade agreement, which it's a tense time in bilateral relations. And I think that we should look back to history and look back at what we can be if we act together, if we are strong as an area, Canada, Mexico, and the United States.
Among the parade spectators is Brian Blevings. He's from Belfast, Ireland, but is now retired and living on Mexico's Pacific coast.
We are really impressed and honored at the way the Mexican people have embraced the Irish heroes. And I think that the camaraderie and the history of Ireland and Mexico are so similar.
Nunca perdamos la memoria histórica. Muchas gracias.
The official speeches describe the epic 1847 battle. The siege lasted about 3 hours. Members of St. Patrick's Battalion were captured and tried for treason. Most of them were hung a few days later. For Blevings, events like this provide great lessons to current political turmoils.
The more you travel, the more you appreciate other people's culture. And the more you appreciate other people's culture, you appreciate how alike we are. And where bigotry comes from, I do not know, but the best way to overcome bigotry is to understand each other.
And before the ceremony ends, a last tune honors John Riley and his battalion. And it almost feels like the spirits of the troops from both sides are back, not to fight, but to honor themselves. For Here and Now, I'm Rodrigo Cervantes in Mexico City.
And today is the formal day Mexicans commemorate St. Patrick's Battalion Day. If you didn't know why, now you do. By the way, we're bringing you the latest from Apple's new smartphone announcement today. That will continue later today on All Things Considered. You're listening to Here and Now.
More than 2,000 people have died in the Mediterranean Sea this year trying to cross over to Europe. But risking death is almost worth it for many migrants when compared to life in detention camps in Libya. A recent UN report condemned what it called inhumane conditions in those camps, which are home to thousands. Joining us now is the BBC's Orla Guerin, who's been inside these detention centers. She's in Cairo now. Orla, tell us first, how do people end up in these places?
Well, there are two ways to wind up in detention. One is to be intercepted at sea, either to be rescued because your boat is sinking or simply to be turned around because the Coast Guard has found you and doesn't want you to proceed. And then there are also migrants who are found out and about, you know, on the streets and are stopped and asked for their papers. And if they don't have the correct permissions, they're put into detention. Now, the key thing to say about this is it's really prison by any other name. Detention can sort of give the impression of a different sort of process. These people are behind bars. They're behind lock and key. They have absolutely no freedom of movement. The only way out is if you agree to be deported back to your home country, and indeed if your home country agrees to get involved in the various mechanisms for taking you back. And the International Organization for Migration is very much part of that process. But we've been told by Libyan officials that some sub-Saharan African nations basically don't want their migrants back. They're saying to the Libyans, they're your problem now, you keep them.
And which countries are these migrants coming from?
Mainly sub-Saharan African. The men we met were largely migrants who had travelled from sub-Saharan Africa. They were trying to get to Italy and trying to get to Europe in search of work. They had all paid traffickers. They had all suffered brutality along the way, a long list of abuses. There are many horrible things that tend to happen to people on this journey. It's quite typical for them to get sold by different militias and gangs. People are routinely beaten. They are forced to pay at every step along the way. We did hear accounts from detainees who were held in a different detention centre to the one we filmed in, where they said they had been forced by the guards controlling it to call their families back home while they were being beaten, so that their families would agree to pay money to secure their release. And we saw one man who had a visible scar on the back of his neck. He said his father had been forced to sell the family home to raise $5,000 for his release. He'd only been free a short time before he was caught again and wound up in detention again. And of course, there are accounts of forced labor and of people being used effectively as modern day slaves.
Well, you spoke with a man named Hennessy Manjing, who is being held in the Trik Al-Sika detention center in Tripoli. Here's what he told you.
This is just hell. It's really uncomfortable. I just feel like a dead person.
His story was really quite extraordinary. Hennessy is just 18. As you heard there, he speaks perfect English, and that's a legacy of his time as a London schoolboy. He actually lived in London with his family for 3 years when his father was working there. And he really wants to get back there. He wants to get back to the UK to try to go to college. Now, he had left home in South Sudan in 2016. He made his way, first of all, to Egypt. From Egypt, he was trafficked across the border into eastern Libya. In eastern Libya, he and a group of about 40 other migrants were kidnapped by an armed gang. They were forced onto the back of trucks at gunpoint. Hennessy himself managed to get away, but wound up being returned back to that gang, who beat him for having run away. Subsequently, his trafficker came and bought him back. There is this buying and selling going on. The migrants are actually commodities as far as these gangs are concerned. And he wound up travelling further across Libya to Tripoli, where he was picked up and detained. Now, he described conditions in a previous detention centre that he had been held in, where he said beatings were absolutely routine, and for any reason at all, and no reason. If you asked for food, if you asked for water, if you made too much noise, you were beaten by the guards.
Orla, the migrant crisis started in 2015. Now, we're not seeing the same numbers of migrants actually reach Europe as we were a year ago. But what is what you've seen in Libya tell you about where we are with the migrant crisis? It hasn't gone away.
It certainly hasn't gone away, and Libya has become the main departure point since the deal that effectively closed the route between Turkey and Greece. And there are some in Europe who would like to see some kind of deal being made with Libya. The European Union really wants Libya to do more to patrol its own coastline, to stop people departing. I really don't see any way to stop that flow except to tackle the root causes in the countries in which the migrants are living, to try to provide economic opportunities there. Otherwise, the pull of Europe, the dream of Europe, the hope for a better life is so strong that people will continue to risk their life on the journey and then risk their life on the Mediterranean.
That's the BBC's Orla Guerin, who has been reporting from Libya. She joined us today from Cairo. Orla, thank you.
You're very welcome.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.